Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Peachgate Pandemonium, a production brought to you by GeorgiaWrestlingHistory.com, where we take you down memory lane for a look at professional wrestling the way it used to be, with conversations from those who paved the way. And now the GWH Radio Network presents Peachgate Pandemonium.
Good evening, everybody. Welcome to Peach State Pandemonium for Thursday, September 26, 2013. This is Michael Norris, and as always, I am joined by my co-host. Well, this week I'm only joined by one of my co-hosts, the Georgia gentleman, Jerry R. Oates. How are you this evening, Jerry?
I'm great, sir. How are you?
Did I throw you off of that introduction? And our other co-host, Bobby Simmons, who's normally with us, is in Nashville for the weekend. He and Mr. Charles R. Smith went up there for Scott Fields' little Tennessee get-together this weekend. But sitting in for Bobby is the great Jay West. And those of you who recognize the name Jay West but can't put a face to it, think back of the heyday of Georgia Championship Wrestling on TBS. Jay was the ring announcer for many years, the TBS shows, and did a lot of the house shows around Atlanta and had the best sideburns in the wrestling business this side of Paul DeMarco.
Well, thank you very much. If I had the hair from those sideburns now, I could certainly put them on top of the head, and it would certainly help out. But I don't have them either place anymore. Well, with Charlie in Nashville with Bobby, I'm sure I'll get the full play-by-play on that from Charlie when they get back.
Oh, yeah, I'm sure. Well, Bobby, actually, you're going to try and call in tonight. I guess it depends on how many people they got crashing in their room at the time that he thinks about calling in. Or...
Right. He told me when they were out in Las Vegas that Charlie booked a real early morning flight for him, and he never wanted to see that happen again. So I hope they're getting along.
Well, I'm sure they are. As long as Charlie keeps his clothes on and doesn't put the Tarzan movies on the television, they'll be okay. but Jay, where else did you do? I know you did the Omni. You did that.
Yes, I did.
House shows there. I'm assuming this is the City Auditorium in Atlanta.
Yeah. Speaking of the Omni, though, you know, it's just thinking about that place. It brings back a lot of memories. But I mean, Jerry can attest to working in the ring there. But there was nothing like stepping into that ring and the house lights, you know, coming up, going down. And having 18,000 people all at once just, you know, put up the roar as Charlie McGowan would ring the bell and we'd get ready for that opening match. It was, you know, certainly 5,000 at the Atlanta City Auditorium. But for that time, in the mid-70s to the early 80s, 18,000 people in the Omni, that was, you know, to me, that was quite an event because I wasn't used to working with that, you know, that many fans.
I can imagine.
Yeah, but I, you know, the night that I was supposed to be on to give my story of wrestling, you had some problems, and obviously, and I kind of went over my career there. But just as a capsule, I started with Georgia Championship Wrestling in '74, worked through late '81, and started doing the TV show and off and on, and then for the last 4 years, I did the TV show regularly. I also worked at the City Auditorium up until the night it closed. I worked all the shows at the Omni until I left in 81. And I worked two places in Griffin, the old Sports Palace. And then when Doug Smith started promoting later on in the late 70s, I worked for him down there. And then, of course, the other big place, Sunday nights in Marietta for a number of years, was quite a hot spot for wrestling. And so on the weekend there, it was not uncommon for me to, within a 50-mile radius of Atlanta, work four shots over the weekend, plus doing my radio work, trying to fit all of it in.
I enjoyed it as much as the boys did.
Yeah, Bobby asked me when I was on that night what I did in my spare time because I was, you know, I was, folks thought I made a lot of money, but I actually it was, you know, putting gas money in the car, but I was doing radio and also teaching broadcasting in town. So I had and I had a band. And
you were involved in music at that time too.
Yes, I was, and actually after to a great extent. Freddie'd always hate it when I'd call him. I'd always give him 2 weeks notice, and I'd say, Freddie, I got a job I can't pass up. Freddie Miller, I'm talking about, for those that don't know who I'm talking about, and say I really need off that night, and so you know he'd do it begrudgingly. But he wasn't real keen on working the city auditorium. He would do it, and so that let me off occasionally to do a better paying gig.
That's what it's about.
That's right. Everybody looking for a better paying gig. So you know, I started out doing a few spot shows before that, and I worked. The International Wrestling Association, Charlie was working with them for a while in the early 70s when he was Charlie Smith, and he got me in with them, and we did a few shows. And so, you know, I just kind of built it up as time went on. And but I enjoyed it. It gave me a chance to announce other than on the radio and, meet a lot of fans. And I was and still am a wrestling fan, so it was great.
Well, good. Do you watch the current product at all?
No, I do not. I try to watch mixed MMA some, and I still try to follow boxing, but most of the boxing I watch now is on Saturday night on the Hispanic channel. I cut down the sound and, just watch the fights. But I really don't follow WWE other than what I read in the Wrestling Observer, and most of my reading in the Wrestling Observer is pretty much, unfortunately, looking for obits on guys that worked when I did, and those that aren't dead are what kind of shape they're in. But I really and truly, I just don't find the current product to be, to my taste.
Yeah, I think that's a pretty common thread with those of us on the show and most of the people that have been on the show with us. But speaking of obits, we lost a gentleman this past week that if neither one of you ever crossed paths with him, I'm sure you knew of him. A true legend in our business and five-time NWA Junior Heavyweight Champion Angelo Savoldi passed away this past week. At the ripe old age of 99, he was just a few months shy of his 100th birthday.
Well,
that's something.
He lived a long, full life.
He was reaching out for that 100, and
I'm sorry
I didn't make it. But, yes, I never worked with him, but I'm familiar with the name, and you can't look at the NWA chart, of the champions without seeing that name.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. He was Danny Hodge's main rival when Danny first got in the business in the early 60s. In fact, the legendary tale was Danny's, one of his very early matches with Angelo, and I think it may have been the time that Danny won the Junior Heavyweight Championship for the first time. It was there in and around Oklahoma City somewhere, maybe in Tulsa. But Danny's father was there, and Danny had never smartened him up. Angelo pulled off something so outrageous that Danny's father came into the ring with a pocket knife and went,
"Oh my God!" Well, I know a story similar to that, but when you did, and I'm very sorry for his death. But I'll tell you what, you scared me when you said the NWA Junior Heavyweight Champion, because I thought you were going to say Danny Hodge.
No, Danny. Lord, I know Danny has never even had a health problems that I know of. Knock wood. Hope he never does. I hope he lives forever.
I know what you mean, and that he's got the grip that you don't want to mess around with.
Oh, yeah.
Where does Savoldi live, Mike?
He was from Hoboken, New Jersey, and I'm assuming he was there. Back in the early '80s, he and his sons tried to. Or a couple of his sons and his grandson ran the International Wrestling Alliance. It lasted a few years, mainly in the Northeast. They kind of merged with Von Erich's group out of Dallas when that started to go south. It used a lot of talent up there, but I think that ran 2 or 3 years. They had television. They had a decent product, but it just couldn't compete. You know, the territories were gone, and it couldn't compete with the production values and everything that McMahon had. And being right there in McMahon's backyard, I doubt it drew. I don't know how well it drew for their house shows, but it hung on there for 3 or 4 years and had a decent group of guys, a lot of guys that went on to bigger and better, and a lot of veterans that were on their way, you know, down the ladder. But it was a decent product for a while. Like I said, they were on cable or some sort of syndication there for a year or two, but just didn't last. But he was from Hoboken, New Jersey, to begin with, and that show of theirs was either from New Jersey or Philadelphia. I can't remember where, but I'm pretty sure he was in New Jersey somewhere when he passed away.
How long? Go ahead, Jerry.
I never did meet him.
How long did their TV show go?
Probably 2 or 3 years, Jay, if I remember correctly. It was on syndication. I think it was on the Financial News Network for a brief period, and somehow or another it wound up as part of Joe Petticino's block of shows that he ran there in Atlanta.
Right.
That's how I saw it. I mean,
how long has it been since it's been out of production?
Oh, it didn't last probably into the mid-'80s. Oh,
okay.
That was early 80s to mid 80s.
That was when things first started falling apart.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, there were the territories were slowly dying away, and what 5 or 6 were left were sending tapes to Petticino, and he was putting it on that block of his out of Atlanta. And I don't know, I guess that got national syndication at some point because there were people all over the country. I think when they trimmed it down to Pro Wrestling This Week,
right,
and cut it down from an all-night thing to 2 or 3 hours, I think is when it got syndication. But I have no clue what network it was on.
Mm.
I mean, it was a decent thing. Joey Savoldi worked there. Vic Steamboat. Tony Atlas was their main heel at that time.
Right.
Who else? I think Eddie Gilbert passed through there. The Von Erichs, or at least Kevin, worked up there. Kevin Sullivan worked there for a while.
Now that you're mentioning those names, it brings back more, you know, it's clearing it up a little bit that I do remember more about that promotion.
Yeah. Their main heel besides Atlas was a guy I don't think ever worked anywhere else, and he was a decent heel. He was a manager wrestler named Tony Rumble. He wore the New York Yankees out, you know, baseball jacket and hat and stuff, played off the rivalry between New York and New Jersey.
Tony Rumble?
Tony Rumble was his name, yep.
And, I never heard of him. But, you know, that might make an interesting show one night, is guys that were really, really big in a territory that never worked anywhere else, you know?
Well, there's a handful of them.
Yeah.
You could go down the whole roster list of Mobile and over the years. And the majority of those guys, because the trips were so short, the money was decent, they could all live on the beach.
Right.
They never wanted to go anywhere else.
Stayed there.
Yep. Jerry was one of the few that passed through that didn't homestead there.
I think he had bigger and better things.
Well, that's true, but I think Ken Lucas pulled so many ribs on him, he just decided he better live.
Oh, my gosh. A sick individual.
How many times did he get you with a rubber snake?
Oh, he only got me once with that, believe me. About tore his car up, man. Kim was a great guy, man.
Oh, man. He's right down the beach from me on the at the flea market on the weekends. I need to try and go by there and see him. Well, we probably won't make it this trip, but maybe on my way back into Florida from wherever it is I'm going, as I have a feeling I'm going to Louisiana. But I don't know for sure. Well, guys, kind of what I wanted to talk about this week, and you guys will know this more than because you were around these types of events. I don't know if my email was clear as to what I meant when I said angles that were built on something outside of the ring and or developed into something outside of the ring. And what I'm thinking about is like in the mid-70s when John Walker had to have neck surgery, they built an angle around Toro Tanaka breaking his neck.
That's exactly one of the things I had written down here. And it wasn't specific just to that. It wasn't just specific to injuries, and I didn't know if that's what you were wanting to tie in on or not. But I can give you one that goes way back. 1963. It wasn't local, but it was the national story. And you, as a historian, you may know a lot about it. The Dick the Bruiser and Alex Karras barroom fight.
Yes, yes.
And... your comments on it?
Well, that was what the Lindell AC, which was athletic club, which Bruiser had a part of, correct? If I'm not mistaken.
Yeah.
Or one of them owned part of, either Karras did or Bruiser did. And did that happen while Karras was serving out his suspension for gambling?
Yes, it did.
Okay,
and the promoter there was named Johnny Doyle.
Right. Which was he was Johnny Doyle was. Jim Barnett's longtime partner.
Right.
They had promoted in Indianapolis. They promoted in Los Angeles. They ended up in Australia. And I think they still had Australia when Doyle died, if I'm not mistaken. And then it wasn't long after that that Barnett sold out and came back and bought into the Georgia office. But,
I had heard a little bit about this story over the years. It was 63. I would have been... 16 or so, and you know, I'd followed wrestling as a kid and into the early days. At that time, I was doing my rock and roll band, and I can remember my father talking about it, and I guess it was, you know, there's still discussion as to whether it was all work or you know, part work and part real, or you know, just exactly how much shoot and how much work there was involved in it. But the angle with the Green Bay Packers for the Bruiser being the, you know, and being the main event guy and some type of feud with Karras relating to his background with the Lions and the kind of being an up-and-coming guy and Karras having kind of a, even though a tough guy, more of a, you know, a babyface type persona, whereas Dick was in the Bruiser was in the middle, you know, the big time of his persona as a heel. And from what I've read and looked at, they tied it to the Madison Square Garden match where the 300 people were injured there, and the fact that Bruiser had been, you know, barred from wrestling there. And he'd come into this bar. He'd come into this bar that Karras was fronting, at least whether he owned it or not. And it started out as a friendly conversation and ended up as another one of those, as Gordon used to call it, Pier 6 brawls. And from that, the promoter got involved. And from what I'm seeing, there wasn't but a couple of days between when this incident took place where the cops were called in and it made the headlines as to when this was the semifinal main event at the Detroit Olympic Auditorium. And right?
Yeah, exactly.
And so what I'm wondering is, you know, there wasn't a whole lot of time to, with posters made, I don't know if there were any pictures or not, and certainly no video, but it sounds to me the posters were out there, is this the semifinal, that there had to have been some, you know, some talk prior to the barroom fight occurring for that match to be made.
Yeah, I'm almost sure it was 100% work. I mean, I'm almost positive it was a work all the way around. I think they had ended up having more than one match, but I'm not sure.
Well, the thing that I thought was interesting was that, you know, I couldn't see either one of these guys with Bruiser being at the top of his game and Karras coming along after, you know, coming off of his suspension and wanting to get into movies and things of that nature. To do a shoot match like that could have been career ending for, you know, either one of these guys.
Yeah,
and,
exactly.
And, you know, as I understand, Karras' payoff wasn't that great, but it gave Bruiser the win, which he wanted, something less than 15 minutes. But Karras, on the other hand, supposedly, you know, did well in the match, and the Bruiser eye was busted open. I'm thinking it was probably a blade job, but at any rate, you know, both of them came out in a positive light, even though Karras was considered the loser of the match, and I don't know that he did a lot of talking about it later on. I know people ask him about it. I think Bruiser was able to just, you know, give winners comments on the match and whatnot, but in my opinion, it looked good to the crowd, and the people bought it at the time. With the media that we have now, I don't know if that would be possible, but you know, I think people believed it other than just the wrestling crowd at that time.
Yeah, I'm sure. Well, Karras, a lot of people don't realize, but Karras was actually a wrestler before he was a pro football player.
I didn't know that.
Yes, he wrestled before he got picked to I don't know if he was drafted directly out of college or whatever, but he had at least one off season when he was still playing college football that he wrestled. And wrestled, I want to say, for the Realm of Detroit there. So, I mean, I'm sure he was familiar with Bruiser before all that happened. And this, I'm sure it was a work all the way around. And you mentioned the New York thing that they were playing off of with Bruiser and Jerry Graham and Carpentier and Rocca. You know, they always built that up as Bruiser was suspended from, barred from ever working in New York again. Well, he worked in New York the next month. You know, so.
Well, in wrestling terms, that's for, you know, going a whole month is forever.
I mean, and worked Buffalo all over, you know, probably the next night as far as all that went. But
one thing that was legit out of that, though, was the crowd reaction.
Yes.
You know, they obviously there was quite a riot there that night, and which was not the only riot that ever happened in Madison Square Garden, but it definitely made the headline.
Even though Bruiser and Graham, of course, they were the heels, so they got blamed for it. But in the studying I've done on that riot, Rocco was the instigator of all that.
Is that right?
Yes, he, you know, he and Graham had a long time rivalry up there, and they worked each other all the time. So, you know, the whole thing where Graham posted him after the match and everything, and I don't know if Rocca did a blade job or what it was, but that's what started the riot, was him, you know, the supposed attack on him afterwards. And there's no doubt that prior to San Martino, Rocca was the ruler of New York. I mean,
sure,
those Latino fans came out there and they saw their hero getting hurt, and that's where the riot started. So
Rocca was really before my time as being somebody that I remembered well, but I do know that he was, you know, along with Gorgeous George, a major, major star in the early days.
Yes, especially in New York.
Yeah.
He and Miguel Perez, which Perez was supposed to be his partner that night, from what I understand. And for some reason, he was not there or whatever, so they added Caponte at the last minute. But, yeah, hey, Rocca was the whole instigator of all that. He did that whatever blades and all that it made, like he was hurt or whatever, that set those fans off. And it didn't take much. It did not take much. They believed in him that much. So, but something similar to this, and I know Jerry knows this, and Jay, I'm assuming you were around back then. I don't know how much you kept up with Columbus wrestling back in those days, but in 66, 67, Don Carson and Galento did, or was it Don Carson, Billy Hines, or Don Carson,
Billy
Hines. Billy
Hines. Billy
Hines. Billy Hines tore up the restaurant in Columbus.
Oh, that was an unbelievable thing, man. That was the talk of the town.
Yep.
That was the talk of the town.
And, I know why I'm thinking Galento back earlier than that, in 63 in Mobile, and this goes back to something similar to the line that Jay and I were talking about before we went on the air. Most towns back in those days had a local morning program or a local noonday program, usually around, you know, cooking and stuff like that. Well, Mobile had one on WKRG, which was Channel 5 back in those days, and may still be, I'm not sure. But they had Connie B. Hope was the local cooking guru who had her cooking show, and she did, you know, talk about society stuff and all that stuff. Well, Mario Valento was a guest on the show. KRG also happened to be where they did the live wrestling matches.
That makes sense.
Right. Friday nights. So there's Mario sitting down discussing whatever the local goings-on in Mobile in 1963 was on the Connie B. Hope show. And here comes Billy Hines out of nowhere in a taxi. And they tear up the whole set.
My God.
So, and that was all just to promote a show in Mobile that coming Wednesday night, Billy Hines against Mario Valento. And it drew, as did the Don Carson, Billy Hines thing in Columbus.
I'm sure it would.
Where was that restaurant, Jerry? Do you remember?
It was called the Capri Restaurant on Broad Street.
Okay.
I would really have liked to have seen the look on the host's face on the TV show when that that started.
You know, she had a little kitchenette set up to do the cooking and stuff, and I'm sure they went over and tore all that up, too.
The only thing I'm hoping is that they were planning to build a new set sometime shortly in the future, and that gave them the opportunity.
Well, I'm sure. I don't know about Columbus with Fred Ward, but I know good and well Lee Fields offered to pay WKRG something in order to let them do that.
I only saw Billy Hines very late in his career. And it was in a 30-man battle royal or something like that that he was brought in for to fill up the ring. And, you know, he was way past his prime, but he did his couple of little things that he did. But I never saw him, you know, when he was in his prime as a worker.
Well, I saw the Hines brothers in the mid-60s, and they would bounce back and forth between working for Fred Ward in Columbus and working for Lee in Mobile. And both of them good workers. And I saw more of Jimmy towards the end of his career, Bad Boy, when he was basically a comedy worker. You know, he'd work opening match,
right,
get a draw or lose or something like that. And most of the time he'd be doing little comedy spots. But and he looked, you know, a little short, fat guy with a crew cut. But from what I understand, he was quite a shooter in his day. And
You don't have to be a big guy in order to be a shooter.
No, Greg Peterson's a good example of that.
Yeah.
But and Billy, I think, is known more for his escapades with his drinking outside the ring than anything else. But he was a tough old guy. I mean, he was a former boxer, and you could tell he.
Yeah, he had the nose.
He had been around a while, and but he was a tough old bird.
Speaking of tough old birds, I would have thought Bobby Simmons would have called in by now.
Oh, I'm sure he's tooling Jerry. I mean Charlie around somewhere.
Something. I kind of brushed you off when we were talking about the wrestling to neck injury thing. Did you want to talk about that a little more?
Well, that was an example of what I was talking about. Now, Jerry, you had knee surgery at one time. Did they work any kind of angle around that, or did you just take time off?
We did it. Yeah, my knee was getting worse and worse and worse. So I told Ernesto, I said, I got to have knee surgery. And he said, well, we'll do something with it. So I was going to be operated on a Wednesday. So that previous Saturday, I worked with Paxson on TV, and that's Paxson did the damage to my knee.
He was one of those guys that were good to bring in to do that kind of deal, right? The Asian type guy.
It went over well. I mean, it went great.
How bad was your knee when you went into the match?
It was bad. I told him, I said, you cannot touch my knee. You can't touch it. You just can't touch it. And the most ironic thing, that's before they had the scope. You know, they did scopes.
Right, they did scope on me.
So I billed him I bailed him out of the corner. He did like a roll, and I went toward him, and he was on one knee, and he chopped me in the front of my knee and on the side, and I still got two scars where Dr. Andrews operated on me from the front and to the side. It's unbelievable. I mean, it's unbelievable. But it went over big. I mean, it really did.
Well, you know, the injury things, there were two kinds. One was the real injury, like Terry's talking about there, and then the other was the not-so-real, which guys would use to, you know, so they could go work another territory or something like that. But the wrestling two injury, which I guess in what I researched in January 75, you know, it was just an age thing. He had to have some work done, and so they used Toru Tanaka and worked it as an angle, and it looked like it, you know, I saw the match. It looked like they billed it as a career-ending injury that Tanaka caused on two. And he went to South Fulton Hospital, which is where he was scheduled. It was on his side of town. And Danny Goddard, the photographer, you know, he told the story, and I'm sure Bobby knows it. He might have something on it if he calls in. But the big deal was sneaking into two's room and giving him the mask so he could put it on for the pictures they had to take for the ringsider, and watching down the hall to make sure none of the medical staff was coming in while they were shooting the pictures, and then get him out of the mask.
Mm. Well, I remember the pictures running in the magazines of him laying in the hospital in traction with his mask on.
Yeah, can you imagine that in real life?
Well, knowing John Walker and the way he protected that gimmick, I could see it.
Well, yeah, but that was the whole point. He was in there as John Walker, I assume, and the gimmick was they didn't know who was there for surgery. But I think somebody would have got a clue if they'd have come in with him with the mask on. The best way to protect a masked man's identity is to have him walk around without it.
Exactly. Yeah. Well, and similar to that, it was kind of in a roundabout way the same, but a little different. The deal that Jay, I know you were around when it happened. Jerry, I don't know if you were working in Georgia or not, but the deal they did with Ted DiBiase, where they had him drop on his head several times. And then
I wasn't here then.
Bobby kind of talked the hospital into letting him stay there to you know, overnight or whatever, ever how many days or whatever it worked out to be for observation.
I wonder who picked
Bobby
up the bill on that.
Moved out into that. I'm assuming that the promotion did.
I'm sure they did. If they were able to keep them there for, you know, for an extended period of time, either that or DiBiase put up a good act on what kind of condition he was in.
Exactly.
And, you know, no guys had insurance or any of that kind of stuff back then.
Nope. But that turned out to be a very well drawing angle.
Oh yeah.
Of course they brought Ritter in from Louisiana, and I think Robert Fuller was in at the time. Robert Fuller may have even been booking at the time, I don't remember.
What year was that?
Late 80, early 81. Before
Fuller,
I started coming over there doing jobs.
Fuller was booking in late 80, early 81.
So, yeah, that was about the time frame.
Yeah.
Because they worked that whole deal with the Freebirds, and they had Stan Frazier in there working, and then Frazier supposedly got injured.
When Fuller would come in, you'd see a lot of his buddies show up when he was booked.
Yep. But, and then DiBiase after that, they really didn't do a whole lot with Ted after that Freebird angle. They put he and Steve-O together and had them as the, I don't know if it was the Georgia or the National Tag Team Champions at that time. They were in the process of changing over the title names. But
right.
And then he went back to work for Watts. But that was kind of the reverse. And instead of the kayfabe an injury and then use a hospital stay as a reverse of doing what Walker did and what Jerry did, and had legitimate injuries and worked an angle around it.
Right.
But like you said, a lot of times, and I guess that's where cable kind of killed it. Somebody get injured in Georgia and they show up in Florida, and, you know.
Yeah, that definitely worked against that angle. And another thing that did it was the magazines, the non-APTER magazines, the Wrestling News, Norm Kaiser, Jim Melby.
Right.
You know, I wrote some stories from them. They started off not as a kayfabe, but not giving away the business either, type publication. But one of the things that they would do would be to put out a territorial report showing where the guys were working. So it was pretty obvious if a guy had an injury in Georgia, and the next thing you know, it's supposed to be career ending or going to put him out of business for several months, and you reading this magazine and he's working in Mid-South, that, you know, the career ending wasn't, it was just not a career ender, you know, and it didn't, that in itself was something that would destroy that type of angle.
Right, right.
But for the hardcore fan, it was something that, you know, they wanted to see where these guys were working, and not trying to, you know, hurt the business, but to actually help the business, just wasn't helping the booking angles that some guys wanted, was to let the fans see where, you know, where their guys were when they weren't in their territory.
Yeah, and that's something, stuff like that is exactly why Lee Fields never had any kind of dealings with the magazines or all that, you know. Different people would be after him, hey, you know, let's try and get some more publicity. And he said, why?
Right.
I'm not worried about drawing, you know, people in New York aren't going to pay to buy a ticket in Mobile. So
right.
That was his big deal. Of course, most of the guys there, and it hurt a lot of those guys because most of them, you know, they were as good as anybody in the country. But since
right.
They didn't travel, didn't get national publication, nobody ever heard of them.
Ken Lucas
is a good example.
That's true.
And Ken Lucas had as good a career as anybody that ever worked in the wrestling business, but he'll never be in anybody's Hall of Fame because he never went anywhere. And he never got any national publications.
And think about wrestling. You know, even wrestling, too. If the Turner Cable had not come along and put him on national television, you know, would Ms. Lillian ever known about him, even though she was from Georgia? I mean, you know, it gave a lot of guys a lot of, you know, it gave them a good push. And let them work places that they wouldn't have worked otherwise because of the territorial aspect of the business.
Right. Well, guys, I'm going to let you keep talking. I just got a phone call. I got a little emergency I need to take care of, but I'll be right back on the air. So you guys,
and we'll
you
be
guys
right back.
Talking.
We'll be right back right after this message. All right. All right. Let me pass along a Jerry Oates story to you, Jerry, and see if you remember this.
All right.
I would imagine, and you may be able to put a date on it, it was probably around 78. It was at the old Channel 17 studios. I know that. And neither you nor Ted had been working in the Atlanta area at that time, but it was, I'm assuming it was Christmas. And you were probably home for the holidays. And I was introducing, it was an early match on the first hour. Saturday morning at 17, and these two guys came into the ring, and they were wearing black boots, black tights, black shirt, and black masks. Do you remember that?
Yes.
I think Ole was probably booking at the time. Not sure, but I think so. But at any rate, the match started, and you guys cleaned out pretty quick, and off came the mask, and it was the Oates brother back in town.
I don't know how that come about.
You don't?
I don't know what the idea that was.
I think it was just to surprise the fans that you guys were there, and supposedly it was to not let your opponents know, like they wouldn't notice these two guys in the back room with these outfits on, running around and wondering who they were going to be working against. And then I think maybe there was some type of confrontation in the ring. Ole may have had something where somebody came in and, confronted you or whatnot, and you were the hometown guys, and you probably cleaned the ring on them. But, I'd never seen you and Ted work much together, but I guarantee you that I never saw you guys work together in those outfits other than that one time.
Is that right?
And I doubt you wrestled and worked in that outfit again, did you?
No, yeah. I don't think we did, no.
I even wondering who you might have borrowed the outfit from, because I don't think it was
You know, that's a great question. I remember that, but I don't even know where we got the gear from.
It looked like, you know, it certainly wasn't anything that, it was the type of work outfit that Jody Hamilton would have wore, but it certainly wouldn't have been his, because you and Ted could have both gotten to the same outfit.
Right.
But at any rate, these were, you know, it looked like something that you guys could have, you know, it was made for you, but I was sure it wasn't your outfit. I assume also that you and Ted had just come in from different territories. You weren't working together at that time, right?
Yeah, we could have been in Kansas City and come home for Christmas or something.
Yeah, I do believe it was Christmas. And y'all, you think you were working together then?
Well, we were in Kansas City together.
Okay.
Because we did come home for Christmas together. Then we went back. But we worked together in Georgia. We worked together in Kansas City, and we worked together in the Carolinas. And that was really about it. Of course, we went in different places for tournaments and stuff like that. But.
Right. It was always a good gimmick to, if you were doing a tag team tournament, to probably bring you guys in together, I would think.
Yeah, we did quite a bit of that. We went to Tampa and went to Dallas, and we went out to watch together. And of course, I worked Louisiana, you know, by myself. But
right, North American champion.
Yeah, and then we would go out there, you know, as a team. But it was we worked Alabama together, Georgia together, Kansas City together, and then the Carolinas. And that was the only places we worked together.
All right. You were, you know, obviously both as a singles and as a tag team, you were hometown guys, and you were always, I remember you were always very, very popular in Atlanta, and I'm sure in Columbus you were even bigger.
It was, and this territory was so great. You know that. I mean, the trips were good. You know, for them, the money was good. It was.
But as popular as Jerry was working with his brother, he drew his real big money working with the McGuire twins.
That's why I got filthy rich.
at least one half of those two.
Has Bobby chimed in? Bobby's on the air with us now. I had to jump off for a minute, but I'm back. I had a circus disaster I needed to take care of.
That sounds like a major event that would make the news.
No, I just had to have a car towed. It's sitting
Uh-oh.
Right in the middle of where our tent is supposed to be in the morning. It's been abandoned there.
Uh-oh.
Such is life of a marketing director with the Cold Brother Circus.
There you go. It's but you've got the title.
Well, that and what they pay me will buy us lunch every day. No, I do well. I love this job. I really do. Bobby, there, you got Mr. Smith distracted.
This is Joe Dimaskowski with K&H Wrestling, and I got an outstanding invoice for two outfits. Yeah, I'm here. I've just been listening. I wanted to just check in, and I'm in the middle of a prayer meeting with Joe Turner, Stafford McGowan, and Charlie Smith. So.
Oh, my God, so to speak.
Tell Scrappy McGowan I defended his honor on Facebook last week. Somebody was trying to put his picture up there and said it was Neil Patrick, and I defended his honor to the death.
I love it.
What's going on with Charlie Smith?
Oh, we just got into town about an hour and a half ago. We're just talking a little bit. We're going to go eat in a few minutes, and
he paying?
The reunion up here starts tomorrow, so we're having a good time. Had a good trip up.
Charlie, is Charlie paying for dinner?
Well, Charlie's paying for the room. He just don't know it yet.
Well, when you guys hear the door slam in the middle of the night, you'll know he snuck out to leave you with the bill.
Listen, every time I leave the reservations up to him, something happens. Last year it was a 6 o'clock flight in the morning out of Vegas.
Uh-huh.
Tonight we're on the second floor rather than the first floor. So, you know, it is what it is, well, but we're having a wonderful time.
Tell Charlie this, Juanita and Bodie called me today. They're going to Mobile tomorrow. They're postering Mobile for the circus. And they weren't sure where they were going to stay. I said, go to this corner, go to the Red Roof Inn and request the Charlie Smith suite.
And there you go. There you go. Wait, have you had your shows yet, Michael?
No, they start tomorrow morning. Or tomorrow afternoon.
Okay.
So they set up tomorrow morning.
Well, yep. Stabby was telling me that they had a couple of sellouts Sunday here in Atlanta, so.
Well,
oh,
good.
I think they had a good run here.
Yeah, it was before the weather fell out. But
yeah,
a few days later, it might have been different.
Yes, you got that right. But, all righty. So you don't know where you're going yet?
No, I
have
not.
Oh, okay. We were talking about
probably
that.
Probably Louisiana, but I don't know for sure.
Okay. All right. Well, I'm not going to hang with you guys long. JWS is after my job, so I will leave it with you guys. And we will. I'll have a report. I'll have a full report next week of all the shenanigans
all right.
that go on up here. So
sounds good.
Anyway, you guys are having a good show. I listened there for a few minutes, and I like the conversation. So,
all right.
You guys hang in there, and I will check in with y'all later.
Okay, Bobby.
All right, Bobby. All right. Take care.
Good night, guys.
See you, Bobby.
All
right. Good night.
Well, all right. All's right in Tennessee.
Sounds like it.
Yeah.
They got it well covered. They got Joe Turner and Charlie Smith up there. That's about as good as you can get right there. And I'm assuming, I don't know if Lucas went up with Joe or not. He was supposed to, but I don't know if he changed his mind last minute or not. Ken's been known to do that at the last minute, decide he's not going to go. So we will see. So anyway, we were talking about Jerry and the McGuire twins.
Yeah.
His favorite subject. He's probably hung up by now.
I thought about doing that, but
No, I never got the opportunity to see Jerry and Ted work in their prime. I wish I had, because everything that I've ever heard about the two of them as a team is just superb. And I saw them both work individually. I saw Jerry when he passed through Mobile in, what was it, Jerry, 71, 72? He
70.
Came in for a few months there.
Yeah.
He
71,
came in for a few months there. Was in... I was very impressed with him. Of course, I knew who he was from the magazines. Ted, I never really got to see much until he started coming in for Fuller. And just the contrast in styles, even though they were different, they still complemented each other well. I would have loved to have seen them as a team.
I saw him a couple of times, and... You know, as Jerry was saying, this was one of the areas that they worked, but a lot of folks didn't because they were, you know, they were busy and they were going in different directions at different times. But as you said, in their prime, and I don't want to, you know, start talking about old folks' home because I'm probably closer to it than anybody else. But yes, they were. You know, when you look at brother teams, you know, there's all sorts of brother teams. There's brother teams that are not related at all, and then there are brother teams that are related but not as brothers. But when you look at the legitimate ones, I would certainly put Jerry and Ted as the in the top category.
Well, I appreciate that. You know, it's a funny thing. A lot of brothers that can get along. You know, whether it was in or out of the ring, but when it come down to the business and being in the ring. We never, ever had 1 minute's problem. Never. Who took the fall, who dropped the fall, we didn't care. Just so we did our job and did the best that we could do. We never, ever had a problem with any of that. Never. Not one time.
You know, and that's very interesting, too, because in the music business, I've worked with relatives, and it's not uncommon to have, you know, cross words before you go on stage. For a variety of reasons, but when it comes right down to it, when you're working with your family, when the lights come on and you're out there, you know, I'd certainly much rather be working with a family member than somebody that wasn't.
And you know, we all our traveling together that we did, never had a minute's problem. I'm not saying we didn't have problems outside of the business, but
right.
when it comes to the business, never. Like I said, we didn't care who took the fall, who dropped the fall, or nothing. But that never entered our mind.
Who did you guys enjoy working with the most, Jerry? If there's one or two particular teams out there that come to mind, because you guys work with so very many and such a wide
variety.
Yeah,
we worked with, you know, Ted really enjoyed when we worked with Thornton and Charles here in Georgia.
Yeah.
He liked that. I wasn't so high on it. I did that European stuff a lot, and I wasn't. But Ted didn't care, you know. Ted was a great worker, very good. Probably the best tag team match we ever had, and a lot of guys said it was the best they ever saw, was with the Cormier brothers in Kansas
City.
Really,
in Kansas City? Wow.
Oh, it was, in my opinion, it was the best that I'd ever had. I mean, it was unbelievable. It just clicked. It was one of those nights that just clicked, 1 hour. It was just, the boys stayed and watched it. They stayed and watched it. It was unbelievable. They were calling stuff in French to each other, you know. And then we would do it with the referee. I mean, it was unbelievable. It was one of those nights that just clicked. But we had good matches with like Waskowski and whoever would be his partner. Who else? When we went in the Carolinas, we worked with Gene Anderson and Rene Goulet a lot and had great matches with them. But
I think Goulet was a very underrated guy.
Oh, extremely. Extremely.
He was.
And
let me tell you something about Gene Anderson. Gene was unbelievable. He was classic. He was classic. I mean, we worked with them many, 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 many nights.
Well, the thing about Gene Anderson, and a lot the same with Harley, even though Harley was a little more active than Gene was, Gene was so methodical, and there was no wasted motion with him. Everything he did meant something, and therefore he didn't have to do a whole lot. He was like Valentine, and Johnny Valentine in that sense. That everything he did
was
so snug and so believable that, you know, there was just no wasted motion. And Harley was a lot of the same way, even though he had his little, you know, his high spots with the diving headbutts and the knee drops and stuff like that Gene didn't do. But Gene Anderson was just so methodical.
He looked like he could cruise on you and hurt him. There was no wasted nothing with him. And, God, we loved working with him, too. I mean, it was just and like he said, Rene was underrated.
Oh, yes.
I thought.
Yep. And, you know, not only a good worker, but I don't think his personality was ever developed as good as it could have been or given the chance to do that. But you know, the interviews I saw him with, I thought he did a good job. And,
yeah, I really liked working with the both of them. I mean, you just knew you was having a good match, you know, regardless. You know, we knew it. We started slamming Gene one night in Columbia, South Carolina. We was tagging back and forth, taking Gene and slamming him. He said, "If y'all slam me one more time, I won't be able to walk." Boom, give him another.
He wasn't famous for his interviews, but, you know, if he was up there in the back with whoever was doing the talking, he could probably do more with his facial tics and things like that than anybody
ever
seen.
Absolutely. And then we worked with him and Gene and Sweet a lot. Sweet Hanson?
Yeah, he was a workhorse.
Oh,
Yeah, I was going to say he was another one that looked like he was hard as marble.
Yep. Let me tell you, Swede wasn't no joke, man. I'm telling you. Well, we had great matches with him. I mean, you know, we weren't greedy in that ring, you know. We weren't greedy, you know. We knew what we were supposed to do, and they knew what they were supposed to do, and it just, I mean, in the ring, we got along with everybody. We never had a minute's problem with anybody. We got along with everybody.
Well, there was a team that you mentioned in the past, and I know you guys went around the horn with, that surprised me, that you said you didn't like working with them and didn't feel like you got good matches with them, was Gorgman and Goliath. I mean, because they were so well known. Was it just because they worked the luchador style more than anything else?
No, they were herky jerky.
Oh, okay.
If that makes any sense to you. They would go from one thing to the other, you know.
I got you.
You know, they were real, I don't know, just, they weren't smooth workers. I mean, they were, you know, in California, just unbelievable. But
I only saw them work together as a team one time. I you know, read a lot about them in the magazines and whatnot. But
oh yeah, they were over in magazines.
Oh yeah, and but during the early days of All South, there when they were promoting on Tuesday nights, the Atlanta booking office ran a few shows at the Sports Arena on Tuesday nights to, you know, work against them, and they brought Goliath and Gordman in, and they were not in the opening match. They were in second or third match, and I didn't get to see a whole lot of what they did because they were there to get a paycheck and get the heck out. I think they were probably working in the Gulf area, Gulf Coast, but I really couldn't tell a lot. I mean, you would think based on what you saw in the magazines about what a you know, great team they were, but
right.
They didn't show me a whole lot that night that I, you know, that I saw them in Atlanta, and that was the only one time that I ever saw them.
You know, we were more into the, you know, we would tag a lot. We'd tag, you know, and it was a tag team match, you know, and whoever got trapped selling, we didn't care. You know, that was just, it was all, we wouldn't say you could do this night and you could do that night. It was just, if the timing was there, we went with it, you know. That's why we got along so great in the ring. It was no, well, you sold last night, I'm a, you know, there was none of that crap, you know. It was none of that.
From what I remember, you know, seeing them that one night, they liked to work the corner together rather than the guys actually being out there in the ring doing their thing. You know, I didn't see a lot from them except trying to get the guy into the corner and then the other guy who was outside the ring, you know, doing whatever he was going to do. And then they break the ref's attention and then build it with the audience. But they were stocky guys, and I didn't see a lot of action there.
We had some good matches. Go ahead.
Just not for their, you know, the publicity that I had seen on them.
Well, their style just wasn't, you know, the South style of Georgia or Florida,
right,
or the Carolina style, you know. No matter where I went, if I was in Oregon or Texas or Florida, my style stayed the same, you know. I always prided myself, and I could adjust to whoever I was in the ring with, you know.
Right.
But that didn't mean I was going to be a herky-jerky guy just because the guy I was in the ring was herky-jerky, you know. I mean, everybody had their own style. That's what made the whole thing click.
Sure.
But we had real good matches with Gordy Nelson and Jeff Ports. In the Carolinas.
When they were Mr. X 1 and 2?
Yes. We had good matches with them, I'm telling you.
I can imagine so. Having seen those two in action, I've never seen them work as a tag team, but I've seen them separately. And Ports is another one of those that I guess he was comfortable with his spot, wherever it was, he was. And he never worked more than mid-card, but was was a tremendous worker and could work with anybody.
But he was taken care of up in Charlotte.
Was he? Good.
Oh, he did a lot of work in George Scott's house. That's one reason. They said he was a heck of a craftsman, you know. Did you know that?
No, I didn't know that.
Well, he could build anything. Wood, you know, like cabinets or staircases or whatever.
Oh, really?
Oh, he could do anything. So he had a good spot up there.
He was big buddies with Johnny Eagles. I met him one time through Eagles. He was
Did he work Mobile?
No, never worked Mobile. Yeah, he came by there to visit Johnny Eagles a couple times. Now Gordon did. Gordon worked. Everybody worked under a hood. Is the wrestling pro number two. He teamed with Baxter. And because Baxter was not, he was a full-time deputy sheriff in Houston County, in Dothan. He was a jailer. Baxter, Tarzan Baxter, the pro.
Oh, Baxter, yeah.
Yeah, so he, he wasn't always available to work the Mobile end a lot. So they brought Gordon in, and he stayed almost a year. And he was like our version of wrestling number two. He was the pro number two, and worked a lot of singles angles and stuff like that, and worked teamed with Baxter some, and they held the tag belts a couple times. But he was a good worker. Of course, I'd seen him in Florida as well, doing opening match stuff and refereeing and whatever else he needed to do in there. But he was a available worker too.
Gordon Nelson worked on the West Coast as Mr. Wrestling at one time.
Yeah, he was Mr. Wrestling. He teamed with, he just died here not too long ago, the nudist. Don, I can't think of his name now, but the Don guy worked as Dr. Death, and the two of them were a team out there. He worked as
right.
Mr. Wrestling in Amarillo, too.
Yeah, Dr. Death, that was his partner.
Oh, what was his name? Don, he just died here last year, end of last year. I can't think of the last name, what his name is.
They're dying so fast.
Where was he from?
He was from California. And we talked about him for a long time. He was a nudist, besides everything else he did in the wrestling business.
I can't think who he's talking about.
It'll hit me here in a little bit. It wasn't Don
Gordon Nelson worked in Georgia as a ref, but he used a different name, and I can't remember what it was.
The Outlaw. He was the Outlaw under a mask, Gordon was, in Georgia. Don Arnold was that guy's name.
Man, don't you hate it when you can't think of a name like that?
Yeah. Don Arnold was Dr. Death. Gordon worked as the Outlaw in Georgia and I think Florida and a couple of other different places. He started with that gimmick in England because he worked in England, even though he was Canadian. He worked in England most of the early part of his career before he even came to North America.
Huh.
And, of course, Port was from England originally. Now, you guys knew Scott McGee was Jeff Port's son, right?
Right, exactly.
Yeah, he was a good worker, too.
I remember seeing him work.
But yeah, I can see where you'd have had been awkward working with Tony Charles and Les Thorne because you were so much taller than them. Whereas
Ted Love doing all that crazy
size.
Stuff they did. I said, you go do it with them, you know. Well,
I love
watching them
work, though.
Some of the holds that they used were, like you're saying, the European style was pretty unorthodox.
Well, Ted was crazy enough, he'd go along with any of it. So I said, you like it, you go for it. I'll do it.
I thought that European style looked pretty good the first couple of times you saw it, but once you saw it, you know. It got over fast.
That European uppercut they threw was
over. Yeah, that wasn't no joke.
You didn't have your mouth shut, boy.
That wasn't no joke.
Yep. I worked with Tony a couple of times. I worked with Les once. Never worked with Dory Jr. because he threw that thing too, and he threw it with
kick you right up out of your boots with.
I saw guys spit blood after seeing that with Dory Funk Jr. He didn't fool around.
The hardest I think that ever threw it with, that I saw was Billy Robinson. I wouldn't have gotten in the ring with Billy Robinson on a bet. He just looked like he could hurt you.
I never saw him live, but I understand he was, as you said, a guy you didn't want to mess with.
Yeah,
he could take care of himself. I was partners with him a few times out in Louisiana.
I didn't realize he had worked in Louisiana.
Yeah, he was out there. I don't think he's doing so good now, physically.
No, I think he's had some health problems. He was on one of our sister shows last year sometime, and was very interesting to listen to. Unfortunately, he had was just getting over a cold, and his voice was real scratchy and everything, but he's still out training guys wherever it is he lives. I want to say he lives
where is
in Tennessee
living?
Somewhere. I think he's in Tennessee somewhere, but I'm not sure. I know that's kind of where he wound his career up, was working heel for Jarrett in the early
days. I did not know that.
Yep. And never met the man. He seems like a nice guy to me, but he's one of those that's got a bad reputation of hurting people. But a lot of people have that reputation that's not true, so I don't know. I know Gagne was afraid to put the AWA belt on him because he wouldn't know how to take it off. I mean, for Vern Gagne to be afraid of you, that's saying something. But,
yeah, there were some guys like that. But guys that were, I'll just use the word dangerous like that. I mean, guys knew it. It wasn't a secret that, hey, this guy, I wrestled, some of the toughest guys that was ever in the business. And I never had any of them, As far as I'm concerned, Briscoe was one of the toughest guys I ever wrestled. I mean, he's good with his fists, and if he ever got you on the mat, or not if he ever got you on the mat, if he decided to take you to the mat, there's nothing you could do about it. I mean, but you never heard Jack say, I was this, I was that. You already knew it,
Yeah. Well, guys like that didn't have to talk about how tough they were, and the ones that talked about how tough they were, 9 times out of 10, they weren't.
Well, there was a lot of that, too. You know that. A lot of guys got beat up in cars. Neville was in the car with people,
Yeah.
But, there were some that were jerks with it,
You find that in every business.
That could handle themselves.
Yeah.
Which, if you can handle yourself, you don't have to tell anybody.
Nope.
But I was always blessed. I never had any problems with anybody. And there were some bad ones out there, I'm telling you. But, if you just put in, do your job, it was the way I made my living, And I love what
I
was doing.
For the most part, even though I was just a job guy, I just did jobs on TV and stuff like that, I never had anybody try and take advantage of me. I never had anybody try to hurt me. Of course, there were some that I avoided working with, not they would have hurt me or not, but I wasn't going to give them the opportunity. Buzz Sawyer was one of them.
I all my years in the business, and I wrestled a long time, and I saw some of those guys take advantage of guys, and guys don't appreciate that, Other guys don't appreciate it, I mean, what are you proving? And Brody was one of the worst.
Yeah, I was in the studio the day he kicked that dude, Lars Anderson, sitting there. Of course, that guy had no business being in the ring anyway. Lars Anderson just took his money, told him where to buy boots and tights, and taught him how to lock up, and that's as far as it was. That was Lars's fault as much as it was anybody's. But Brody didn't have to do what he did to him. And he did apologize to the guy, but, apologizing to somebody who's got all their teeth kicked, that ain't helping much.
No, that's not, you know. I saw him take advantage of a guy on St. Louis TV, some green kid. I mean, you know, the guy was probably petrified of him anyhow, you know. But guys like that, that weren't a Briscoe or a Billy Robinson or whoever you want to throw in that mix, you know, they picked their spots too, those guys did.
Yeah.
And that was so unfair, you know.
Well, other than his somewhat could-be cruel ribs on people, I never heard of Johnny Valentine ever taking advantage of anybody. You know, because Lord knows he could have.
I think that was part of it, knowing that he could have. You know, that's all it really took. You know, you didn't have to worry about keeping people in line if they knew they were capable of hurting you real bad, real quick. You respected them.
Yeah, and of course there was a lot of guys not defending them the way they did it, but back in those days, people don't understand how we protected our business. And I say we, I don't mean that I would have ever done it, but guys like, you know, Bob Roop, when you'd have these guys show up to think, hey, you know, I play football, so, you know, I can be a professional wrestler, there's nothing to it. And that was the attitude they came in with. Well, you know, right or wrong, that's how we protected our business back then.
Exactly.
If we had to stretch a guy, or, you know, somebody had to stretch a guy to, you know, get him to shut his mouth, you know, because you knew, you Jerry, you went through training and you had a little bit of advantage because you had Dick, but I'm sure it would have been the same situation. Had you gone through it one time and quit, you know, the worry was, hey, you know, that's why nobody was ever smartened up day one like they are now. You know,
oh, absolutely.
You never went into it knowing for sure it was a work. I didn't. People laugh at me and they say, when were you smartened up? I was smartened up the day before I had my first match. You know, I learned how to do things. I learned sequencing and I learned how to, you know, break falls and stuff like that. But it was always, when it was being taught to me, it was being taught to me, this is how you keep from hurting yourself. This is how you protect yourself. It wasn't, this is how you cooperate with your opponent. That was never brought up. And people just don't understand that now. Of course, go ahead, Jerry.
I don't think Hans Smith ever learned that. I don't know if you ever had the pleasure of that or not, friend.
I've seen him. That was enough.
I thought it was a joke. I thought it was a joke going on, man. I hadn't been in the business no time. They booked me with him on Tampa TV. I thought the man had lost his mind or something.
You didn't start by asking him, could he work, did you?
Well, that bell rung. I found out he could. I don't have that man kept a job.
Reversing it, Jerry, as you progressed there, did you ever see a situation where you got into a ring with a young kid and he either thought he was something and you felt like you had to protect yourself, or if he was not that kind and he was just a kid wanting to get into the business, whether you kind of took it easy with him?
I've had some that were, you know, we called them green, you know, that would try to. When I was trained, you know what I was trained to do? Protect the guy I was working with.
Mm-hmm.
That's what I was taught. Protect your opponent, you know. And yeah, I've run up on some guys like that that were green and want to call stuff, and I don't know you. I've never seen you. I'm not getting upside down in the air with you until I know that you know what you're doing, you know?
Yeah.
There was some of that. And then I'm not talking about having to hurt somebody, but, I mean, there were some guys you'd have to snatch a little bit and get a little smug with them, just tell them, settle down, just take it easy, you know? I mean, you know, the wrestling business was a work in progress. You never got through learning, you know?
Sure.
It takes years to get where you feel like I've reached a point that I feel comfortable with being in the ring with a Jack Briscoe or a Harley Race or a Dory Funk or whoever. You know, I feel like I can do what I'm supposed to do with any of these guys. And that don't happen overnight, you know. It's by working with different guys every night, different styles, different size guys. Some guys that work faster, some guys that work slower, you know, some guys that are more methodical, like a Harley or a Gene that we talked about, you know. It just takes a long time.
Right.
And that's not done overnight. I don't care how gifted you are.
Yeah, I learned that in the music business. If you worked with guys on a regular basis, it's a lot different than if a fill-in guy came in one night. You know, with the guys you worked with regularly, you could almost know what they were going to do before they did it, you know.
You don't have to say a word, right? It's
right.
Just there.
Yeah.
It's just there. Are you still in the music business at all?
I'm sorry?
Are you still in the music business at all?
Not in a paying capacity. My wife and I had our own band for 10 or 12 years, and I got too old to haul equipment around, and she said that she wasn't making enough working for me. So, you know, we dissolved the band, but we still do occasional stuff where we just do it for pleasure and for organizations that are, you know, that
right.
We think are needy and, you know, and that we can do something to help them out with. But we do, you know, 50s and 60s and 70s music, so it's something that you know, our kids are not going to come to see us do it, and we're not getting paid to do it, so to heck with them. But we play for a lot of groups like that, the older groups and some of your veterans organizations still, but it's not a money-making operation anymore.
Well, what do you play?
I play guitar and bass, and I started playing when I was 8 years old. I was eight when Elvis first appeared on the Dorsey Brothers TV show in 1955, and took it from there. Started playing guitar, and when I was 13, I was playing in a rock and roll band in high school, and continued on doing that until 1966 when I got drafted and spent 2 years in the Army and came out and went in the radio business and went back starting playing again. And I never, never made a living as a musician, which is, you know, kind of oxymoron there anyway, as a journeyman musician, but always made money, not a whole lot. And basically I retired from it as a money-making process, to retire our band at the end of 2001. And so from that point on, it's, you know, you got the equipment, you don't want it to just sit there and collect dust. So we rehearse a little bit, my wife and I. Like I said, we just did a job for a little senior citizens group here this past Monday night. And it's just an occasional thing, just, you know, for them and for us. And it's we enjoy continuing doing it in that fashion. She's a great singer, my wife.
I respect people that can do that, sing or play an instrument. I can't even play a radio, you know. I mean, I respect people that can do that.
Right. Well, it's, you know, me in the business, it was, you know, I was never a great talent. But as a band leader, it was kind of like a booker kind of job, you know. I always felt like my job was finished when the equipment was set up, the contract was signed, and all the musicians were there. Then I could do whatever I did, but the show could go on and let the other people be the stars on stage, you know. And because it takes background people to make showbiz happen just as well as it does the people that are out there in front.
Oh, absolutely. And you know, I mean, you had to have loved doing it. I mean,
oh yeah, yeah. Because it's just like, you know, you can't stay in the wrestling business if you don't love it. There's too many knocks there,
yeah.
And there's too many bad paydays, and there's too many people that, you know, irk you. That was the I almost said something else, but that's irk is the word that came out. And so at any rate, it's something you gotta love. Some promoters would take advantage of that, but you know, what comes around goes around, or vice versa of that. And you know, if bottom line, if you know, you're not a star, you're a journeyman at best if you're trying to make money at it, and that's what you do, and that's why you do it, because you love doing it.
Exactly
there's,
right.
There's a lot of similarities between the music business and the wrestling business. You sit there, and I'm sure Jay, it's happened to you. You're pouring your heart out, you know, playing and all that, and you look in the front row, and they're sitting there talking to one another, not even paying attention to what you're doing.
Yeah, that happens.
Happened to all of us in the wrestling business. But anybody that listens to the Bob Seger song, Turn the Page, whether you're in the music business or the wrestling business, if you can't find something to relate to in that song, you just I don't know if there's any help for you, because
you got that right.
That song applied as much to the wrestling business as any could possibly have if it had been written for the business. You know, by being the long days on the road and you know, you stop in to get a bite to eat somewhere and you're freezing cold and all that stuff and you feel everybody staring at you. You know.
Yeah.
Of course, you know, the wrestling business had a few more oddities in it than the music business did. But
maybe at that time, but I wouldn't say so now.
Looks-wise, yeah.
But you know,
you're right.
But, you know, there, to me, you know, I've been around a few bands and all, but there's so many great singers and guys that can play and that never get that break, isn't it?
Well, you know, and I had an advantage there because I worked both sides of the street, working starting in '68 when I got out of the Army and going into the radio business. At that time, you know, it's a certainly different ball game than now. But I mean, records were brought into you by promoters. And there was just so many slots you had, and you'd have excellent, excellent people. I mean, great voices, great production, and you knew that song was never going to get played on the air. That's the unfortunate side of the music business, is that you got people out there that think, hey, I got talent, and because I got talent, I'm going to be a star. And
right.
It's just like in 99% of the time, it's more the will to, you know, to put yourself out there and actually humiliate yourself in many cases, and just being in the right place at the right time.
Timing, isn't it?
Yeah, you know, it's like Ted Allen said. He worked the last show at the City Auditorium. He had his bag with him. Old, he said, "You got your bag." You know, had he not been there that night, he would have never worked the City Auditorium. That was the last night. And it's just it's that's all part of it. But having great skills is not going to guarantee you that you're gonna make it in the business. And I've seen people that spent every last dime that they had, thinking that was going to be what it was going to take to make them a star. So you know, a good musician learns that if you want to make money and you know you want to make a living in the business, you're not out trying to do that. You're trying to find a good band you can work with and seasoned musicians and not look at whether you're going to be the next big star or not, and be sure you show up on time and that you're not, you aren't altered and that you're not trying to mess around with the band leader's wife and that you do a good job there, and then you may have a job the next night.
What's that sound like, Jerry?
Exactly. Exactly.
You know, you've got guys who play music for years that are happy. You know, they're well known in their circuit and they make a decent living at it. They don't have to have a daytime job. You know, so they'll play every nightclub along the Alabama-Mississippi border. You know, they'll play in every little nook and cranny in Mobile, Pensacola, and all that, and they stay in that area. And it's just like it was in the wrestling business in the territory days. You had guys that you know, made a decent living and stayed in one territory, had short trips, and went home every night. And it's the same way.
You're right.
Yeah.
And if you luck out and just happen to be in the right spot at the right time, you know, showbiz, it could happen. But don't sit around expecting it, because if you do, you're going to be sorely disappointed.
When I was in the music business, I used to tell, when I would manage bands, I said, the music business doesn't need to be called the music business. It needs to be called the rejection business.
That's
because
right.
You get more rejection than you do anything else. And if you do not let that, you know, you need to keep an even keel. You don't need to get too high if somebody pays a lot of attention to you, and you don't need to get low if, you know, somebody doesn't pay attention to you. If you work at it, you're diligent enough, your break will happen. It may not be a great big break, but it'll be a break.
That's right.
And that's what I used to tell people. Oh, man, when I would manage bands, they'd, they think, oh, we're going to, you know, have a hit record and we're going to sign this contract and we're going to get all this money. And I'm, number one, don't ever, 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 ever borrow money from a record label against your earnings.
And don't go with a manager that says, you know, you give me this money up front and I guarantee you, you know, you're going to be a star because he's going to be gone with your money.
Exactly. I never even took any money from any of the bands I managed until I got them signed.
Well, so, you know, that's the way to do it. But people are so, you know, they want it so bad that they're willing to, you know, unfortunately, to do that kind of thing. And I can't even imagine what it's like now with the internet and YouTube and everything else that you've got.
Yeah.
You know, people thinking, you know, I can do this ridiculous thing, and people are going to see me, and I'm going to get all these hits, you know, on the internet, and then I'm going to be a star. Well, you might be
there
a laughing stock.
What's that sound like, Jerry?
you know, you might be a laughing stock star.
Yeah,
and you know,
really
like,
think about it. These guys that work for, you know, these crazy, you know, flips and go through tables and work with weed eaters and chainsaws and all this stuff in front of 15 people, thinking, well, somebody's going to see this on YouTube and Vince is going to call me tomorrow and offer me a job in New York.
They go see that and call some mental hospital.
Right. If they still have their fingers, if they still have the fingers the next day after working with a chainsaw.
I mean, it's all, but it's everything's timing, like what we talked about. Right place at the right time, and the right person.
Exactly.
Pay your dues and hope for the best.
That's it. Hope for the best.
Yeah. And I think, Jerry, and not trying to blow smoke up your behind, but I think that's one of the reasons why you're so respected by so many people in the wrestling business today, because word of mouth, you know, Sam Mushick heard about you, wanted you on St. Louis TV, you know, Geiger wanted you out in Kansas City, and you and Ted both. And it's because you showed up, you did your job, you weren't any trouble to the office, and, you know, you were never late, and you never questioned, you know, the role you were given. You just did your job. You earned your money.
And you know, and I appreciate, you know, you saying that, and I feel that way because, you know, Ted and I never showed up drunk. You know, we didn't drink. We didn't come in smoked up, doped up. We was, like you said, always, or if we had to be there at 7, we were there at 6:30. Did what we was asked to do. Never complained about a payoff. You know, I figured, you know, whatever was going to come was going to come as long as we did our job and worked hard. And that was just us. You know, that's the way we were raised, and that's the way we were. You know, I'm not saying I was satisfied with every payoff, but... You know, I'm not going to say that. I don't think anybody would say that. But you know, that's what I chose to do, and I love what I did. And I got to do a lot of things. I got to go a lot of places. I got to meet a lot of great people, you know, and I had a – it was a wonderful experience for me, you know. And I'm just glad I did it. Of course, you know, I'm reaping the day – you know, like with my knees, but my knees are doing great and got a bum shoulder, but, you know, I still work out and I still take care of myself, and thank God I'm able to do that. So I did what I wanted to do in life, and I got no regrets.
You know, that you can't say more. You can't hope for any more than that.
No. I mean, I, you know, I even look back at what I did, the things I did and the places I went, and it's like, here's a guy from Columbus, Georgia. I did all these things and went all these places, and you'd have had to been a very, very wealthy man to go all the places I went to. And I was paid to do it and sent a ticket to go do it. Yeah, you know, how blessed is that? But some people wouldn't give you a quarter for all that. My dad thought my brother and I were crazy for doing all that, you know.
Well, my mother, you know, and she finally went out, but she, you know, she would, her story with me was always, when are you going to get a real job? And you know, that was both based on the music business and also the radio business. You know, finally in 84, I left and went to work for the federal government. Because of that, I've got a retirement. tied to that federal government job that I retired for in 2009. But fortunately, I was able to use some of my skills from the music business and radio in my government job. But you know, it's really the same thing. You wonder, you know, when you start out on that road, how things are going to end. And the best you can hope for is that you get out of it what you put into it, and that people are happy with the job you did.
That's all you can ask for.
That's right.
And
also, you could look yourself in the mirror and know you did the best you could do, and you were respected for what you did. You know, you didn't have to stab somebody in the back or run with a blubbering stooge on this person to get their spot.
Well, no,
and that's
that wasn't my makeup. You know, if I couldn't get it on what I learned to do and was willing to do, then, you know, let somebody else do it. And it went on like in anything else, you know. But that wasn't my cup of tea, so.
Well, you were talking about four different guys that you got comfortable working with. Was there anybody that after you've been in the business a while, say 10, 12 years, that you stepped into the ring? I know you've mentioned here in your first year that you worked with guys like Schmidt and Lufez and Briscoe and people like that you were in awe of. Was there anybody later on in your career that you had never worked with that when you got in the ring with them for the first time, you were kind of starstruck a little bit with them?
The first time I ever worked with Dory Jr.
Really?
I'd been in the business 20 years and never worked with him.
Really?
Yeah, I was in awe of him. Absolutely in awe.
You know, that's another one. Even though he spent, you know, nearly 5 years as the NWA world champion, that's somebody who, for his work, does not get near the respect he deserves.
Oh, this,
I mean,
listen.
People nowadays look at how boring he was, and he couldn't talk. He didn't have any hair. He wasn't muscular. Watch one of his matches. Watching against Briscoe in one of those hour draws that
all you have to do, like I've said a thousand times, you could take any critic in the world, you couldn't pick it apart. Impossible.
Nope.
I think I think Dory would put together one of the more realistic matches, particularly a lengthy match.
Exactly.
And you know, it, like you said, trying to find the flaws in the match, trying to look for the worked parts of it.
Yeah, it's not
there.
Hole in
you can't
hole.
Do it. It's not there.
It was just, you know, he did, particularly the lengthy matches, the close to the most perfect matches that I've seen of anybody, you know, of that era. I enjoyed every match that I ever saw him in.
He,
you know, people give so much more credit to Terry, but Terry, I think, is based on his personality. He was nowhere near the worker that Dory was.
Well, like you said, he had the personality, and Terry's work, to a great extent, as far as I was concerned as an announcer, was more done before the match started than, you know, as the match progressed. He'd get wild, and, you know, the fans would get worked up, but he had them worked up before the match ever started. And that was exactly the opposite of Dory. He came out there and, you know, he could have been a stockbroker for all he was for the way he walked to the ring and the way he went up until the end of the introduction and the bell rang.
And
totally different. But
I enjoyed seeing
Terry work.
You know, people had no idea how big Dory really was.
No, no. He wasn't a little fella. No. Not at
you
all.
You're going to pick him up and slam him. Don't think he wasn't heavy. But he was to me, I was in awe when I got in the ring with him. I really was.
Those, you know, his spinning toe hold was his finish, but those elbows of his, they you know, they were perfect. And I'm sure if you felt those elbows of his, I mean, you know, they looked as dangerous as anything I ever saw in the ring. The way
you should have felt it.
No,
but,
I wouldn't want to do it. But
here's the beauty, you know, he didn't throw punches.
Nope.
He didn't throw punches. You couldn't pick his work apart nowhere. It wasn't. He was the epitome to me of a professional wrestler.
I think his
fact that he took funny bumps. He bumped with his elbows.
He took funny bumps.
that was one of the first things I ever learned was when you took a bump, especially on your back, you did with your wrists down and your hands flat. He did them with his elbows up.
Did you ever see Jack Briscoe take a tackle?
No.
Look it up.
I have, but I don't remember.
Nobody. I've never seen anybody take a tackle like he took one.
I know one thing. Jack Briscoe, he and Ricky Steamboat threw the best arm drags I've ever seen. They're the only two I ever saw leave their feet doing arm drags.
Yeah, Jack started that. When he works with Junior and does it, I almost faint when I watch it. I pull it up on YouTube just to watch it. I mean, it's absolutely gorgeous.
Yes. Yep. And that's
Mike,
the thing you mentioned, how big
the
room was.
Go ahead, Jerry.
I said I hate to cut this short, but I got to get up super early in the morning.
You and I both. I got to get up at 3:30 in the morning.
Not long from now.
I'm close, but not that close.
I got to be on the lot at 6, and I got some stuff I need to do in the morning before I go. Well, Jay, I appreciate you sitting in with us. We will definitely have to have you on with us again.
Well, I certainly enjoyed it. I hope so. Hope I didn't embarrass you folks too much.
Not a bit. It's always a pleasure having you on.
Thank you very much.
You finally got Jerry out of his shell. Only the way I can do it is to mention McGuire at the Windsor T-shirt.
I told the story about the black mask and tights. I don't know if you were on the line when I was telling that
story.
No,
I wasn't.
Well, you'll have to listen back and hear it.
All right. I will do that. Well, again, guys, I appreciate it. I will be calling in next week from parts unknown. At this point, it's parts unknown. And Bobby, Jerry, and I will be back on. And Bobby will have a full report for us for the Tennessee reunion.
Oh, I'm sure.
Let's see if anybody got mad about a payoff up there.
Oh.
And again, Jay, it's been a pleasure having you on with us. As always,
I enjoyed it, gentlemen.
We'll definitely have you back on as a guest. So,
yeah, please do.
Thank you very much.
All right. Thank you, guys, and good night. We'll see everybody.
Good night, guys.
Good night.
We thank you for listening to this broadcast, a production brought to you by GeorgiaWrestlingHistory.com and the GWH Radio Network. Stay tuned to GWH for nostalgia, upcoming events, and more. As always, GeorgiaWrestlingHistory.com thanks you for your continued support.